This week on Your Western Context, Alberta rejects permanent summertime and equalization. Margaret Trudeau speaks at an event by a company lobbying the government, and Saskatchewan approves of Regeneron to treat COVID. Also, we look at just how much money laundering affects BC real estate. This is Western Context, episode 242, recorded Friday, October 29th, 2021. Dirty Laundry. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself have returned yet again for another episode. Justin Trudeau's cabinet has been unveiled, and alongside that, we have a bunch of other news stories to talk about.
Yes, that was indeed the news that was talked about the most this week, but we're going to delve into some other stories that should have received a lot more coverage than they did because of what has been happening in Canada this past month has really hinged on these untold stories.
That's right. And you look at this and you see all these different news stories that don't pop up, and everybody has been so hyper-fixated on the cabinet, but we're in our cabinets or in our Canada stories, we're going to talk about why it might not be as big of an issue as people think it might be. Granted, it does have a huge impact, but of course, we have all the reasons as to why the individuals who get put into said cabinet might not have as much power as people think. But of course, we'll get to all that in due time. We're going to start off with Alberta this week. And if you want to follow along with us, you can find our full show notes at westerncontext.ca, where we've been removing the bias and sensationalism from the news going back since January 2017. And in removing all that bias and sensationalism, we hope to provide all the information and context necessary to put you, our listeners, on the right side of the news. And if you want to help us do that, you can also check out our Patreon at patreon.com/westerncontext. We have a number of benefits there that we'll talk about in a little bit after our first story. But we're going to start off with Alberta this week. We have the referendum results, both referendums. We have the Senate election results. And of course, we are also monitoring the developing story involving a potential sexual harassment claim out of the Premier's office. And here at Western Context, we believe all allegations must be followed through on and the full story must be learned before commenting. As a result, we're going to be monitoring the story into the weekend and providing coverage on it next week if necessary. But we're going to continue on with our coverage of the municipal election results from last week to start with. And the two of them drew a lot of attention province-wide, and one of them specifically across the country. We're going to start with the Daylight Savings referendum, and this was defeated in a narrow Brexit-like defeat where the no side won by just over 5,000 votes, coming in at 50.2% no to 49.8% yes. This means for Albertans that clocks will continue to change twice yearly. Surveys published in the past suggested that a higher number of residents would want the clocks to stop changing, and this implies that either those surveys were wrong or these people who participated in these surveys did not get out to vote. There's also the possibility that Albertans would have favored on staying on standard wintertime and losing an hour of light in the summer, but that was not an option in this referendum. Now, interestingly enough, smaller municipalities in the rural areas of the province voted to stop changing the clocks, while larger urban centers like Calgary and Edmonton voted to keep the status quo. In relation to the other referendum question that the experts, so-called experts, say doesn't matter in relation to equalization, 61.7% of Albertans voted yes to remove equalization from the Constitution, while 38.3% voted no. The only jurisdictions to resoundingly vote no were Edmonton, Banff, and Canmore. On the results, Premier Jason Kenney said that a clear majority of Albertans have sent a powerful democratic message. They want a fair deal in the Federation. These results have given Alberta's government a powerful mandate to secure changes to equalization and other federal transfers that have treated Albertans unfairly for so long. Our message is clear. Ottawa must respect Alberta and the huge role we play in Canada's economic prosperity. And because of the impact of this, this is our quote of the week. Now, once again, we need to be 100% clear that just because the province voted this way does not mean equalization will go away immediately, if at all. The next logical step to have the most impact on this would be for the premier to bring it up at the next first minister's meeting with other premiers and suggest a constitutional amendment. And that amendment to pass would require the support of 7 provinces on board, representing 50% of the population. Now, the more likely alternative is that it begins a discussion with the federal government on fiscal fairness, which is what the so-called experts are trying to say won't even happen, going to a point of encouraging Justin Trudeau to just ignore the referendum, Jason Kenney, and Alberta entirely. Because after all, in their view, it was Jason Kenney's conservative government that he was a part of at the time that negotiated the current equalization formula. But as with most things, that lacks context and is a very short-sighted view, since equalization has been transferring money between provinces since 1957, and for the vast majority of this time, Alberta has been on the contributing end. Now, ignoring this referendum will fan dangerous flames that could evolve into something much more dangerous within Alberta and Saskatchewan and other western provinces. Something that could lead to a strong showing of Western populism, or Western separatism. And it's just that point. Quebec has used the threat of separation or referendums to bring a message to the federal government and has been largely successful at it for decades. Somehow, Quebec manages to operate with the most freedom and within the Canadian Federation while still receiving generously from programs like equalization and other transfer funds. Alberta needs to be a leader today, especially with the appointment of Stephen Guilbeau as Environment Minister. Mr. Guilbeau doesn't want oil, gas, or nuclear power, and the latter, which can help get us to a greener future and address climate change. Now, the question is whether his environmental roots will be a problem for Alberta. Of course, this equalization referendum drew coverage from all across the country, and even former Prime Minister Jean Chrétien chimed in, and he said, when you're in Alberta, it's almost a culture of complaining. And when you look at that, and you look at the former Prime Minister's words, that's an interesting comparison, because, as I mentioned, Quebec has almost become a sovereign state within Canada while still receiving equalization in all the federal programs that we enjoy. What this suggests, on the other hand, is that Alberta needs to take the path of Quebec and follow their own playbook. Now, in a final note on this story, we also need to point out the hypocrisy of the media and their biased coverage on this matter. First, it was being framed as a referendum on Jason Kenney and his COVID leadership, while this suggesting that the federal government should just ignore the results. And if you go back in time to September and August, there were lots of people in the media suggesting that this referendum might not pass because it could be turned into a referendum on the premier based on his leadership. But now that we have the results, that 62% of Albertans voted yes on this, more than actually voted for the UCP in the last election, there's lots of questions that have been being raised in the media if the results actually paint a clear picture. Those in the media will note that only 38% of Albertans voted in this referendum, and with that, just over 49,000 ballots were left blank on the question of equalization. But at the end of the day, it's not the fault of a government, or it's not the fault of a media, or it's not even the fault of anyone external if an individual person decides not to vote on a specific question or in a specific election. That is entirely up to each individual, and these people are making this decision, and to infer that this is sending some sort of message to the province or sending some sort of message to the federal government is really short-sighted in the eyes of the media. Now, failing that argument, it also becomes a question of whether or not anyone outside of Alberta should even pay attention, because according to the media elites, Alberta is one province, Erin O'Toole lost in September, and Canadians wanted Justin Trudeau, apparently, despite the minority Liberals getting the least number of votes ever for any sitting government. And it's that argument that says that, okay, maybe the Conservatives lost federally, maybe Alberta is just one province, the federal government is a Liberal government in charge, why should we even pay attention to Alberta? And you can see how the goalposts have shifted on this. And as it goes in the field of communications and persuasion, when the argument shifts or you have a myriad of reasons of why something could have happened rather than one specific reason with a thorough thought analysis behind it, or you attack the messenger, if you do any of those, you're losing the argument. Now, in capping off our municipal election and referendum coverage, I'll also say that in the Alberta Senate election, the Conservative Party of Canada candidates took the top three spots, winning a combined 46.6% of the votes, while former Alberta Progressive Conservative Minister Doug Horner, who ran as an independent, came in fourth, and the independents as a bloc garnered 38% of the vote. With that, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau would be best served by appointing any of the Conservative or independent candidates on this list who, at the end of the day, won a majority of support of the Alberta population.
Yeah, the municipal elections and the referendums that happened at the same time were really interesting in the sense that you got a lot of information out of what the people in Alberta actually wanted. It's clear that in the bigger cities of Calgary and Edmonton, they wanted to keep the status quo when it came to changing the clocks, whereas in the rural areas of the province, they actually wanted to stay on the same time zone yearly, which I think a lot of people might not have thought that that would be how the referendum went when it was originally put out. And given the government survey that was done here in BC that led to 93% of respondents wanting to stay on the same time zone yearly, it was thought that in Alberta it would be much the same, but quite clearly that's not been the case. And, you know, well, the results speak and elections do matter, as we say. And, well, the results mean that Alberta is not likely to change its clocks anytime soon. When it comes to equalization, I think it's been quite clear for some time that Albertans as a whole would want to have a better deal coming out of equalization, and Justin Trudeau keeping the status quo last time it came around and renewing the exact same terms despite Alberta going through a economic recession at the time due to slumping resource prices, which were in part caused by the federal government's lack of initiative on development. You know, it is something that it's no surprise to many outside of Alberta that they'd actually want this. And the real surprise here is that a greater number of people voted for looking at equalization a bit further than had voted for the governing party, the UCP. And that's something that a lot of Canadians should really take note of, because when you have such a high majority, regardless of the turnout of the referendums, because we all know that municipal elections draw a lower voter turnout than both provincial and federal elections do, it still should be taken into regard and taken a look at. And I think that when it comes to the federal government, it's quite clear that we need a government in charge that will communicate with the provinces a lot more and try and balance the needs of the citizens, because the citizens in the provinces, well, they have different needs, and certainly across the country, provinces act a bit differently. But in the end, we're all Canadians, and I think that that's something that the federal government should take note of.
Yeah, and this equalization referendum also provides an interesting path for the UCP, and nobody else out there has said this. If you can take these people who voted in favor of looking at equalization or deleting it and add to it and combine it with your 2019 results, you have a very impressive number of people willing to support something the UCP wants heading into the 2023 election. Now, combine that with the fact if Justin Trudeau is still prime minister come 2023, and the fact that the NDP in Alberta want nothing to do with referendums, and you raise the question that, you know, if the NDP were to fall back into power in 2023, they would likely bring in a provincial sales tax. And you say that, okay, that's a discussion we can have after the pandemic. We'll do it with the referendum. The UCP could say that. And as a result of that, you build a fairly interesting and broad coalition of people who support referendums, support looking at equalization, and you build that issue as an issue against what the NDP would do, and of course against the Prime Minister as well. And this is, of course, probably going to be the ticket and main ballot question of the 2023 election, unless anything major happens to change in the next 18 months or so. And that's something I have not heard mentioned elsewhere. But this is definitely setting that up to be the discussion, of course, if Justin Trudeau and Rachel Notley are still leading their parties and maintain the stances they do on equalization for the Prime Minister and the use of referendums for the NDP here in the province. And that's something that Albertans have been very vocal about, even going back to the history of the Reform Party, everybody standing up to support something they like. And you can even do that here with Western context. I'll just take a moment here to mention our Patreon page before we move into our next story. You can find it at patreon.com/Western Context. There, for as little as a price of $2 a month, you can help us remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media. Or if you want to give a bit more, for $5 a month, you can help us continue to do that and have your name read out on the podcast if you want. And for $10 a month, you can become a Western Context insider and gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production show notes throughout the entire week. Now, of course, you're probably wondering what we're going to be using this for. Well, when we reach $30 a month in contributions, patrons will receive an exclusive monthly news article expanding on topical stories of the month. And this article will continue to provide the context and information you've come to expect from us. At $60 a month, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month where we reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and provide opinion on where affairs are headed next. But we also do have an option to make a one-time contribution as well via PayPal, which you can learn more about at westerncontext.ca/support. Now, it's been no secret, of course, that Justin Trudeau likes to involve his family in politics. We had the whole discussion of the Wii scandal in the last parliament, and we are looking at something that has kind of the same echoes, except this time with Justin Trudeau's mother.
Yes, that is indeed the case. An organization that received $5.8 million from the federal government to help job seekers from underrepresented communities is now refusing to say if it paid the Prime Minister's mother, Margaret Trudeau, to speak at an event it held this past month. Now, Margaret Trudeau appeared in Elevate.ca's Think 2030 series on October 14th to speak about mental health and the effects of the pandemic. Elevate is a Toronto-based not-for-profit that says its mission is to, quote, unite Canada's innovators to solve society's greatest challenges. Now, Elevate currently lobbies the federal government for funding through FedDev Ontario, which is a federal regional economic development agency, and as recently as 2019, Elevate was also registered to lobby the Prime Minister's office for funding for one of its events, Elevate Tech Fest. Now, in June, the Federal Economic Development Agency for Ontario announced that it would provide the funding for the organization's Elevate Talent Program, which was intended to help people from marginalized groups to find jobs in the tech and creative sectors. Now, past payments to Margaret Trudeau and other Trudeau family members by We Charity were the subject of an investigation by the Federal Ethics Commissioner, Mario Dion. Conservative MP Michael Barrett is calling on Dion to investigate whether Prime Minister Justin Trudeau violated the Conflict of Interest Act yet again for yet another Trudeau family member being involved with an organization that is lobbying the government for money. Now, Barrett suggests that the appearance raises questions about Section 6 and 7 of the Conflict of Interest Act regarding whether the Prime Minister has advanced his mother's private interests by directing money towards the organization. Now, Barrett's letter to the Ethics Commissioner also states that this is not the first time questions have been raised about the speaking engagements of Trudeau's family. He said, quote, Mr. Trudeau's failures in the past to respect Canada's ethics laws make it particularly important that scrutiny is applied to any and all potential conflicts of interest. Now, this story has pulled little attention from the media as Trudeau finally announced his new cabinet on Tuesday, as we mentioned at the top of the show. Some highlights are that Chrystia Freeland remains as Deputy Prime Minister and Finance Minister, Wall. Others have been shuffled around, and veteran MPs Mark Garneau and Jim Carr have been swept out of cabinet altogether. Now, while the media discusses who is in which portfolio and what this means for the country at large, the end result is that little has changed as a result of the cabinet shuffle. The power is still concentrated within the Prime Minister and his PMO, otherwise known as the Prime Minister's Office, which gives mandate letters and direction to the cabinet. Now, despite the media distracting everyone with the new picks and talking about it for pretty much the entirety of the past week, the real event that could have sparked change was the election in September. And as we see with the Margaret Trudeau story, with yet another Trudeau getting money from an organization that is lobbying the government for money, well, not really much has changed at all.
It's the pattern of behavior. It's the pattern of behavior that we saw in the election that we saw. Even in the Trudeau majority government, it's the same thing time and time again. The Trudeau family, or people close to the Trudeau family, people close to various ministers, as happened previously with Bill Morneau, they tend to benefit from what the Prime Minister does and what the government does in terms of where they funnel money. This wasn't a surprise when we saw this, and perhaps that's why, in terms of looking at the media coverage this week, it was just a blip on the radar compared to everything else, when in reality, this should have been a huge story this week, along with the fact that this is a returning government, a two-time returning government, that took over a month to put together a cabinet, when in reality, in most government changes, they do it in 2 to 3 weeks. And you have to ask just what the heck was going on in terms of everything that was happening in terms of that cabinet building. But lo and behold, here you can see that we're not even back in Parliament yet until the 22nd. And it's business as usual in terms of handing out money to firms that benefit the Prime Minister and his family.
Yeah, we knew exactly after the election in 2019 return to the Trudeau minority government that tended to govern exactly as it did when it had the majority government. And, well, we knew that when it was looking like Trudeau was going to get back in with a minority government again, that he would just keep governing the exact same way he did for the past 2 years. And the election that could have meant change really didn't deliver on that, and well, it's business as usual. And well, for the Trudeau government, business as usual means that family members get to have cushy private lives that are benefited by organizations that get government money for their funding. And this is something that's turned up time and time again. And it's not a surprise to see this story again. What is a surprise is that this keeps happening, and yet the media decides to not focus on it because I guess for some reason they think that people care who's in the cabinet more than they care about scandals. But nevertheless, we were here to give you that story because we feel it's much more important than something that isn't going to change much when it comes to the power that is coming down from the very top.
Yeah, and we also have to keep in mind that everybody is calling this the Trudeau minority government, and we said on election episode that you don't elect minorities. That only happens once they test the confidence of the House. And today we have a story that we had a story that the federal government was going to appeal the court ruling against First Nations children. And then a few hours later, Friday afternoon, of course, before everything starts shutting down, they say, oh, we're also going to start talks on the resolution. And this is a fancy way of saying, yeah, we're going to appeal it, but we're just going to delay by talking about it. And the point behind this is that there's 3 weeks to go until Parliament comes back. A lot can happen in 3 weeks regarding this and other stories. And we just need to remind everybody out there, of course, that this government has not tested the confidence of the House yet. And, you know, we live in strange times. Anything could happen. This government could still fail to pass its throne speech, depending on this resolution and if this Margaret Trudeau story continues to blow up anymore. So it's going to be a very interesting next 3 weeks before the throne speech and the vote on that. But we also have another story this week. And this is a story that touches Saskatchewan, but it's something that every province in the federal government needs to be aware of, and that's that Saskatchewan has approved the use of monoclonal antibodies to treat high-risk COVID-19 patients. And one of the starkest comparisons that we see in the COVID pandemic has been the differences between Canadian provinces and similarly sized U.S. states. U.S. states have lower vaccination rates and are able to operate without restrictions. We've talked about healthcare capacity per capita in the past on Western Context 237, but one thing we didn't look at was the treatment options for people who wind up in hospital. And one of those options, and it's been an option for almost a year now in the U.S., is called Regeneron. And this is the experimental drug that was given to President Donald Trump when he contracted COVID last year. Regeneron is a combination of drugs that effectively spurs an antibody response. It uses lab-made antibodies and gives the person in question an initial immune response. And the U.S. purchased almost 3 million doses of this drug at a cost of $2,100 each. But as recently as this past September here in Canada, the thought of using that drug treatment in Canada was not really on the radar that much. And we had to ask why. And, you know, you have to wonder with that, because the reason that it works well in mild and hospitalized cases for people who don't have antibodies, or otherwise known as previously uninfected or unvaccinated people, is because they don't have that initial antibody response, and Regeneron provides that and gives them a stronger chance of fighting COVID-19. The treatment is delivered via one-hour infusion, and according to Dr. Teresa Tam, it's not about the cost in Canada, but the feasibility of delivery. Now, logistics is a problem that Canada did not nail down until late in the pandemic, when it comes to life and death, we should have been moving Earth to make the treatment available. One of the shortcomings of the inherently public health systems in Canada is that they lack the innovation and competition necessary to move things faster, as would happen in the private industry. But now, a month later, one Canadian province is leading the way, and that province is Saskatchewan. Now, you have to ask the question, how were we able to wait nearly a year after the U.S. authorized this experimental treatment before even questioning to start to use it in serious cases here in the country when lives were at stake? Now, of course, Canada's fourth wave of the pandemic was seen as a pandemic of the largely unvaccinated, and Regeneron couldn't have been used to blunt its damage. Starting this past Monday, certain patients in Saskatchewan will be able to self-assess and, starting November 1st, receive Regeneron treatment. The self-assessment tool will be used to see if a person is eligible for this monoclonal antibody treatment. Anyone who is unvaccinated, immunocompromised, or is immunosuppressed will be able to access Regeneron regardless of vaccination status. Patients will also need to be within 5 days of becoming symptomatic, and patients will need to be 55 years or older or 18 years and up with a high-risk comorbidity. The treatments will be made available in Regina and Saskatoon. Now, Canada, of course, built a vaccine distribution network, and each province was tasked with setting up immunization centers. There are hospitals in most municipalities that would be capable of carrying out IV therapy treatments, so it's more a question of getting the medications to hospitals rather than the cost involved. And you have to ask, yet again, why did we wait a year to start doing this? What's more, the treatment can be given in an outpatient setting, which is crucial when it comes to conserving hospital bed space. Each and every province should be building plans and requesting doses of Regeneron. Costs should be no issue whatsoever, because our governments have spent and seem to be focused on building back better, as they say, and all the spending that that entails. But nonetheless, our best ally, the United States, approved a treatment almost a year ago that seems to work in keeping people alive, and we're only starting to use it now. So with that, something has to change with our COVID healthcare response here in Canada.
It's amazing to see these healthcare strategies that seem to be slow to take off in Canada. And a lot of people in Canada tend to pride themselves on how good our healthcare system is, when in reality, I think that the COVID-19 pandemic has really shown the vulnerabilities that exist in the Canadian healthcare system, and that really are slow to adapt to new situations or don't have the fallback capacity of other areas around the world. And certainly with a lot of the hospitals getting loaded up with COVID patients, we've seen that stress on the system, not just in the public health system, but also in other companies around the country that have had problems with staffing issues or having problems with feasibility or with pay or, you know, any of these things that we've seen across the larger labor market with the large number of people looking for new work and changing their professions. We've seen all of these issues happen, and it's hit healthcare really hard right now because of all the issues that COVID has surrounded it. So with this treatment that's being available, it's surprising that the Canadian healthcare system and Dr. Theresa Tam and others who are in charge of these sorts of things wouldn't look at this much sooner, because getting our healthcare unburdened is on the forefront of a lot of people's minds right now, and something that should be able to do that should be in the running for consideration. But it seems that once again, Canada's lagging behind in what is going on.
Yeah, and you know, you can say the same thing even with approving the Pfizer vaccine for people aged 5 to 11, because the government seems to be operating in a position where data doesn't flow freely. But all the data that the US FDA has and that everybody has in the world is available practically instantly. The US FDA today approved the Pfizer vaccine for people aged 5 to 11, and there's no reason why we shouldn't be moving at the same pace as the US FDA on things like the Pfizer vaccine, on things like Regeneron. We have all the data. We could collaborate with the FDA if we wanted to in the US. Canada Health could, but we're not for some reason, and that would drastically improve results for people here in Canada. And it's just absurd that nobody has the foresight to think about doing this. And maybe they're afraid of becoming too close with the US, but at the end of the day, the pandemic calls for a different way in thinking. And I remember one of the first episodes we talked about, we said that this is something that is going to require a different way of thinking to get through. There's going to be lots of inventions that happen through this. And if we don't think differently through this, we're not going to be able to be successful. And we're seeing Canada doing that again, both with Regeneron and the delays that we're seeing right now with the Pfizer vaccine for young people. And even as we saw with the vaccines in the beginning. So there's lots of questions that should be asked, and nobody's asking them. But of course, you can ask the questions, but it doesn't help if the story flies completely under the radar. And once again, we're going to look at the Lower Mainland, and in particular, some actions happening with the Chinese Communist Party.
Yes, exactly. And as we mentioned, stories that are really impactful don't really tend to go anywhere if the media doesn't talk about it. And with our firing line story, well, we have to take note that much of the BC media is gawking over the fate of the container ship that grabbed headlines this past week, first for getting into the storm off the coast that ended up nearby in Victoria and Vancouver, that first had a huge windstorm that knocked out power to many assorted regions, and then, of course, a huge rain front that yesterday on Thursday had the eighth most rainiest day in Victoria record. And that is, well, that's something to note in and of itself. But the container ship, of course, first lost what was called 40 ship containers in the storm. Later on, we found out that it was about 100 containers that were lost. And then shortly after that, a fire broke out on the ship due to a highly flammable potassium compound that shifted movements during the storm and ended up in places that it shouldn't and caught fire. And, well, this ended up causing quite a great commotion on the ship just off the south coast of Victoria that people put all over Instagram. And, well, it sent toxic clouds of smoke up into the air off the south coast of Victoria and spread out over the city as well. So while people were talking about that, and while the fridges, Christmas decorations, and other assorted retail goods floated up on beaches all over the west coast of the island, well, another story had flown under the radar of BC coverage this past week. Now, everyone knows that Canadian real estate has gotten wildly out of control. The inflated housing markets of Toronto and Vancouver have crept into almost all other cities as well, and with the inflation crisis upon us, things are reaching their breaking point. And it's not just people in Canada noticing this as well. Outside firms internationally have noticed the insane housing bubble that Canada operates under right now. Moody's Analytics, a very large credit agency firm that tracks finances all around the world, released its Canadian real estate model this week, and it shows that markets are overvalued by up to 91% across the country. That means that homes are selling for 91% more than what they should be, and that's quite a big deal when you consider that's almost twice the number of in sales. Swiss bank UBS ranked Toronto number 2, only behind Frankfurt, in this year's Global Real Estate Bubble Index, with Vancouver coming in at number 6. Now, examples of the inflated housing bubble can best be shown by real examples. Early in October, a small East Vancouver home sold $551,000 over its asking price. The very small two-story with a basement home sits on a 24 by 122-foot lot, which is much smaller than a standard cut in Victoria or Vancouver, with a frontage of just 33 feet. And a front lawn of just 33 feet is really not that much at all. Now, the detached home was listed for $1.699 million on September the 8th, and it sold 7 days later for $2.25 million. Now, the property had an assessment in 2021 of about $1.5 million, which means that it sold for more than 50% above its assessed value. It sold for $1.535 million back in February of 2018. Before that, it sold for $950,000 in June of 2010, and about 14 years prior, the property sold for just $231,000 back in November of 1996. Now, Adam Major, who is a managing broker with Hollywell Properties and who's also the CEO of a real estate information site, notes that when you look at the percentage increase in value over the last 25 years, that means that this property, on its own, has outperformed the stock market. And Major goes further and says, quote, "This means that since 1996, the house has increased in price by 9.53% per year, compounded annually for 25 years. This is an almost tenfold increase. That is better than the stock market. The S&P 500 returned 7.23% per year over the same time period. If you reinvested all dividends, you would have made about 10.04%. Still, with the S&P, you would have to pay capital gains taxes, but not with your primary residence in Vancouver. So comparing the two, Vancouver real estate definitely has been the better investment over the last quarter century than the stock market." And this is what Major has come up with. Now, it remains to be seen just how much of this housing bubble has been driven by money laundering. Since the Cullen Commission of Inquiry into Money Laundering in British Columbia was launched just over 2 years ago, it has held 5 community meetings around the province, undertaken thousands of hours of investigation, research, and interviews. It's held 143 hearing sessions over roughly the same amount of days, heard testimony from almost 200 witnesses, with an additional 23 witnesses providing evidence via sworn affidavit, and it's received over 1,000 exhibits, and it's also now released its interim report. And all of this work has come to the conclusion that money laundering has had an enormous impact on the value of real estate in BC, and likely this has also had cascading effects on the rest of the country as well. Conservative estimates from a report from professors Maureen Maloney, Sir Somerville, and Brigitte Unger titled Combating Money Laundering in BC Real Estate, indicates that there was about $5.3 billion laundered into BC real estate just in the year of 2018 alone, thus leading to an increase in real estate prices. Now, a case study from the Cullen Commission has focused in on a citizen from China who reported an average annual earnings of just over $40,000 per year to Canadian border agents, yet went on to buy $32 million worth of Vancouver real estate after moving $114 million from Hong Kong-based depositors with connections to organized crime and the Chinese Communist Party. Now, the study is just one of over 1,000 commissioned exhibits, and it hits on a number of vital aspects of money laundering heard over the course of the 18-month inquiry, such as nominee purchases, obscure corporate structures, fraud, layering, and placement of assets, particularly real estate, and with links to organized crime and corruption. And where have we all seen this before? Well, we've talked about this with Vancouver real estate before, but we've also mentioned this when it comes to properties owned by Chinese holding companies that end up having ties to either organized crime or the ruling Chinese Communist Party, or even both. We've seen this with healthcare industries. We've seen this with financial firms. We've seen this with property. So this should not be a surprise to anyone that this is still happening 4 years after we first broke this on one of our very first stories in Western Context way back in 2017. Now, this anonymized study of this particular man from China, which mentioned no names, well, it described a family affair of suspected money laundering, which included both a man who it also described his wife, as well as their child and his mother, to move funds from Hong Kong-based depositors or so-called money changers, and into luxury homes in Vancouver, as well as at least one Bahamas-based shell company. Now, the man had come to Canada back in 2006 with a total declared family assets of $1.25 million, but became subject to a deportation hearing under the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act back in 2016. A number of reports to the Financial Transactions and Reports Analysis Center of Canada, known as FINTRAC, the National Financial Intelligence Agency of Canada, seemed at odds with his declarations. Documents in the study also show that the man was listed by Interpol as being wanted for bribery. The immigration proceedings are now sealed, according to the Commission Counsel, so we don't really know what happened there, but it's quite clear that he was allowed to stay. Now, between April 2006 and November 2014, the man and his family members received about $114 million from Hong Kong. Much of that money moved through an investment holding company listed in the Bahamas, which was listed as being owned by the mother. Now, the company held $34.6 million in three different accounts, and documents show that the wife, listed as a homemaker, unemployed, and CEO, which is a very interesting list of attributes, ordered transfers from institutions listed in Switzerland, China, Singapore, as well as Canada. Now, FINTRAC reports show that the money moved in 60 separate electronic fund transfer reports, 7 large cash transaction reports, and just 2 suspicious transaction reports. Now, the man and their wife bought their first home in Vancouver for between $2 million and $3 million, according to the study. Now, exact details have been redacted, but it's also noted that the child, listed as a student, then bought a $14 million home in 2012. The man bought a second home for at least $15 million in 2016, the same year that the child bought a second property in the $1 to $2 million range. The properties were tied to one another via mortgages and names on land titles, but it's unclear where all of the other money went to. Now, overall, the commission found limited open source information about these depositors, despite the large amounts of cash flowing into BC. One of the depositors operated in an obscure building belonging to an auto repair shop. The study states in reference that almost no information is available about these companies online. Now, depositor Hinghua China and HK Renminbi Exchange Company, which made the most deposits to BC accounts, was found to have shareholders named Fang Xinghua and Hinghua. These two individuals were accused of operating an underground bank in a Chinese court dispute, but were determined innocent of the allegation. Fang, who owns a number of Hong Kong businesses with his family, has also faced charges of assault and criminal damage. A business associate of theirs is Fong Si Luk, who is a co-shareholder of jewelry shops with the Fang family. Now, the study notes that, quote, Locke has a somewhat higher public profile than other Fang family members. He became head of the Hong Kong Lions Club in 2017, and in 2011 and 2012 was one of Hong Kong's delegates to the Chinese People's Political Consultative Congress, otherwise known as the CPPCC, of Feng Kai, which is a region of Guangdong just north of Hong Kong in China. Now, the CPPCC is a branch of Chinese Foreign Influence Program, the United Front Work Department, which we have actually talked on the show before as having influence, influence into BC's elections and into Canada's elections in the past. Now, this is according to the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission. Now, the commission goes on to detail some of the connections that this Mr. Locke has, including to a woman named Seto Yuk Lin, who is a described, quote, gaming tycoon widely reported to have close connections to organized crime, particularly Wang Kwok Koi, a.k.a. Broken Tooth Koi, who is a leader of the 14K Triad. Now, in 1997, Wen had ordered a hit in Vancouver against Lai Tongsang, who is a alleged leader of the rival Shui Fong Triad. Wen was sentenced to prison in 1999, and after being released in 2012, is alleged by the United States Treasury and others to have continued to conduct criminal activities. Now, likewise, the commission has heard testimony about alleged Chinese transnational organized criminals operating in concert with local gangs and using BC casinos as a means to launder drug proceeds by loaning cash to gamblers. Now, Justice Austin Cullen may also weigh in on his views of foreign capital impacting the Vancouver real estate market and to what extent Canadian laws mitigate any risks of that money being from criminal activity. Cullen has heard broadly from experts that it is difficult to pinpoint the exact quantity of money laundering in real estate. But one thing is clear, money laundering in BC is here, and it's happened for quite some time, and that foreign nationals, largely from the People's Republic of China, have been taking advantage of lax oversight and lax laws, both, to take advantage of the real estate market. The BC governments, both present and past, have either been slow or ineffective at combating the problem and may even in the past have encouraged it. Who knows? This huge story about the Cullen Commission flew completely under the radar in the media, and while everyone talks about housing prices and how terrible inflation has got, no one really talks about why they are the way they are right now. And this insight into the Cullen Commission and with ties of hundreds of millions of dollars, even billions of dollars, flowing into Canada from organized crime proceeds and with ties to the Chinese Communist Party, well, it remains to be seen that this is just the tip of the iceberg.
And we also need to realize that the people who get affected by this the most are the people in BC who want to buy houses, the people who live in BC and can't afford a house. And this is something that the BC NDP should be standing up to. It's something the BC Liberals should have stood up to. And it's something that, given the massive nature of this, is also a national security problem, and federal government and the election campaign should have looked into as well. And it's just utterly absurd that no one, and we say no one, and we really mean no one at this time, because the BC Liberals could have stopped it. The BC NDP could stop it, or at least look into it. The federal Liberals could look into it as well from a national security perspective. The Conservatives or the NDP could have made it an election issue, but nobody is talking about this. And this is perhaps one of the biggest sleeper stories that keeps popping its head up in terms of Western context history. And it's just going to keep getting worse and worse as time progresses. And we're starting to get a glimpse into just what it looks like. And, you know, previously we thought it might be a few isolated cases here and there, but this is actually starting to look like an endemic problem that is plaguing the lower mainland, the island, and who knows, maybe even other parts of BC and maybe even other housing markets in Canada if we took a close enough look.
Yeah, exactly. It's quite clear that this is a bigger problem than previously seen. If just this one person could come into Canada, say that they only have $1.25 million in family assets and say that they only make $40,000 per year, and yet somehow they're managed to buy several properties over the course of the years and to be able to flow almost $120 million into Canada, there should be questions about this. And that should have been, this is something that happened over a very long period of time. This is not something that happened recently or instantly. This is happening over decades past. And this is something that should have been raised before. But it's quite clear that there is either no teeth when it comes to FinTrack and in being able to prosecute or even investigate these people, or that the government's involved are not providing the full amount of attention to the problem that they should be. And that's something that really doesn't get talked about very much. And this one report that came from business in Vancouver is really the only one that really highlighted what the Cullen Commission is talking about. Or, you know, to put it in real terms for ordinary people, what all of the lawyers and the court cases were talking about. And that's something that really should be done by the media a little bit more. If they can't talk about the news, they should at least be able to talk about what's going on and to put that in real terms for people. But they aren't, and that's why we're here to do that, and that's why that story is our firing line.
Yeah, and, you know, we've had a couple of cases where firing lines can delve into the provinces, and rightly so, because they are those stories of the week that don't get talked about. And they also form the locus of, well, our main focuses for the week, including words of the week, which comes from this firing line.
Yes, our word of the week this week is laundering. When you use it to refer to money, it means to conceal the origins of money obtained illegally by transfers involving foreign banks or legitimate businesses. And, well, just in the BC story that we've seen, there's quite a few instances of laundering that have been happening in BC, and the effect that they might have had on the greater real estate market is still unknown at this point, but it's quite clear that it has had a huge impact and that this problem is not going away anytime soon. So that's why laundering is our word of the week this week.
Indeed, indeed. A big problem for all concerned in Canada. And, you know, even if you're listening from outside of Canada, this is what we're looking at in terms of our real estate industry here. It's an issue that needs to be addressed by some level of government. Whether or not it does is it's looking like not at this point, but if it would, that would be a story we would come back to cover as well. And we've been on this story since nearly the very beginning of Western Context. If you want to look at the show notes for this or any of the other episodes or stories relating to this, you find them at westerncontext.ca. You can also subscribe to the podcast on any number of podcast listeners out there. Find them at westerncontext.ca/subscribe or on Apple Podcasts, Google, Pocket Casts, and more. And just visit westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And of course, we're also on social media on Twitter and Facebook at Western Context. So with that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll be sure to look through all the stories that the media talks about and a lot that they don't talk about in covering the stories that really don't get as much attention as they deserve, whether on TV, radio, print, or online. We will find them and we will give you the context needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. So with that said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.